Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Sunday night, and going to get kind of musical here with someone who not only has his own really cool guitar style and props and creds and whatever silly words people use like that, he's also worked with some amazingly major figures in rock and roll. So we're going to talk to him about all that kind of stuff, both his own work and the work that he's done with others. He's a fellow named Gary Lucas. He's a Grammy nominee, and he's been praised in places like Rolling Stone and The New Yorker and all sorts of places like that. But the place he is right now is the neighborhood, and we're happy to have him. Hello, Gary. How you doing?
Hey, Dave. Nice to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And so what is the latest thing you're working on? Let's get that out of the way and tell people what they can see and what you're doing.
Okay. The latest thing, I mean, I have many ongoing projects, and I'm finishing some of them up, but I just, over the weekend, finished up a new album with one of the ensembles that I lead, and that is a band called Fast and Bulbous.
Yes.
You may know that phrase from Captain Beefheart's Trout Mask Replica record.
And
we are indeed a Captain Beefheart tribute band. He was my original mentor in music, and I spent 5 years playing in his band and managing him as well.
Well, okay, so right then, that was kind of what I was going to be saving towards the end, the B part stuff, because I was really going to be talking about that Najma.
I'm sorry. I'm just
no, it's totally
the
cool.
Most recent, yeah. Because I just finished that recording. The most recent project, which I am not quite done with our record, but soon to be, is Najma Akhtar and I have great new project, which we're going to debut at Joe's Pub May 3rd. It's a Saturday night,
right,
at 9:30, and that is very dear to my heart. Najma, if you don't know her work, she's an incredible London-based Indian vocalist who I am aware of originally through some great records that she did that came out on the Shanaki label here in the U.S. I picked them up in the early 90s and became a fan. And so the next phase was I had a solo show in London. And this was last spring. I went over and we met and right away, you know, found that we had a lot in common just talking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a little bit of playing and she did a little singing. So it sounded good to me and I invited her on a show. I was doing, maybe it was that night, but she just winged it, and she was fantastic, and people responded to it.
Good.
And I started to send her material, some instrumental pieces. A lot of the times, my best song collaborations come from me first coming up with instrumental guitar pieces, and then the vocalist can fill in a missing melody, maybe, and lyrics. And that's how my collaborations with Jeff Buckley, the late Jeff Buckley, came about.
Oh, I didn't even know that you worked with him.
No, I co-wrote two of his most famous songs, Grace and Mojo Pin, that were both on his one and only official album, Grace, which came out on Sony in 94. He used to be in my band, Gods and Monsters, for about a year.
He was, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. And did you know his dad?
I didn't, no, but I loved his father's music. I thought he was really a wonderful player and singer.
Let's start at the very beginning.
Whether you're at the very beginning, the middle, or the end of the Broadway season, everything you need to know about Broadway, off-Broadway, cabaret, opera, and dance is in the pages of Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. Available 21 times a year or just in the monthly edition. Either way, Dave's Gone By listeners get 10% off. So subscribe now to Performing Arts Insider and find out all the information at PerformingArtsInsider.com.
I'll make it easier for you.
Hi, this is Gary Lucas, and you are listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB in Freeport.
You can't help, obviously, but bring up these amazing people that you've played with and composed with. So let's just run through them. Yes, Najma, wonderful, and everybody on May 3rd, go see her. But And Gary Lucas playing as well. But the other thing...
So we're playing together, so we hope that people will look at it as a duo. I'm hardly her backup guitarist on this gig.
Oh, no, no, I didn't mean it that way, yeah.
No,
that's cool. You're both collaborating on this ongoing project.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But you've collaborated with her, with Jeff Buckley, with, as you said... Oh, let's just go right to the beef heart. I can't not.
All right, okay.
So you were just a fan. You were a totally rabid fan of Captain Beefheart's music.
Uh-huh.
Growing up, where were you?
Grew up in Syracuse, New York, upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I first heard the name Beefheart by chance. I was in high school still, and I was hanging out at Syracuse University, and I spotted a kid on the street up there with the longest hair I'd ever seen anybody have at that point. It was down to his waist.
Mm.
And he spotted me because I was carrying an English import copy of The Move's first album. They were this great English band, not very well known in the U.S. And at that point, nothing had ever come out, but you could get this record on import.
Uh-huh.
And he was a big Anglophile and a music fan. So we started talking, and he was carrying a guitar case on which he had written Captain Beefheart and his magic band in a red magic marker on this acoustic guitar case. So I said, who's that? He said, that's a band from L.A. that my brother just produced. So I filed that away. I didn't think much about it. But about an hour later, it dawned on me, wait a second. And I said, is your brother Richard Perry, who had just produced Tiny Tim's first album on Warner Brothers? He said, yeah.
Wow.
And his name was Fred Perry. Fred now operates a great music store up in the Woodstock area called Reservoir Music. And anyway, Fred and I became fast friends. And but I don't think I actually heard any Beefheart music until a few months later. And then his second record was released. It was called Strictly Personal.
Very weird.
Very weird.
Yeah,
I didn't really like it, honestly. I got it for $1.97 as a cutout. Shortly after it was released, it was cut out. That's what happened to most good music in the day.
Right.
Unfortunately. But it grew on me over the years. The one that really did it for me, though, was the next one, Trout Mask Replica, which was on Frank Zappa's label, Bizarre, and produced by Frank.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's one of the great...
One of the great albums.
Outsider art music albums ever.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you, you were more of a musician already then. You were already playing guitar, you already liked some music, right?
Sure.
So, first couple of times I heard that album, I couldn't make head or tails of it.
Right.
I thought it was noise.
Me too.
Okay, I was just checking. That's
sure.
The response.
That's
everybody
most people's reaction. I know.
Yeah.
No, it sounds like chaos, but... A couple of listens will, if you really have a good ear, you'll say, everything is all, worked out. It's not random at all. These are very sophisticated musicians playing very difficult music. It's almost like neoclassical music because, just...
The rhythms, the
rhythm,
the guitar isn't going...
Anyway.
Yeah, it's just...
Yeah. It's very difficult music to play.
So then you realized that Trout Mask was unbelievable. You became a fan.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, and then there are great melodies on it. It's just that they're not your typical pop music melodies at all.
Right.
And it takes a bit of work, but I think it's work that really pays off to close listening because he had a lot to say. First of all, lyrically, his lyrics are very poetic and deal with ecology and a love of nature and animals and the way man has kind of screwed things up, mankind, let's say, and very visionary. And then it's expressed with his amazing voice, which spanned many octaves. And anyway, for someone like me, I mean, it's music for people who are kind of bored with the average pablum, that constitutes most of the commercial music that we know.
Yeah,
this is no offense to commercial music makers. I mean, I respect anybody doing anything, at all creative in music.
Well, I like
a lot of commercial music, but, in my taste, my ear kind of shuts down and I recoil.
Even the people who are making some of that music. A couple of weeks ago on this program, I had Tony Powers. I don't know if you know of him.
No.
But he was a brill building writer, and he wrote a bunch of songs for Don Kirshner, and he worked with Phil Spector and all those.
Oh, yeah, wait, I do know Tony Powers.
Tony Powers, yeah. And then after 7 years working at the Brill Building, he one day came in the weirdest outfit ever, barefoot, and wrote a song about how he lost his watch and was now telling time using his penis. And it was then Kirshner knew that was his resignation. That was the pink slip that he was handing to say, I'm going to go off and make some very different kind of music, which he did. He went into a much more avant-jazz, pre-Tom Waitsian Tom Waits kind of stuff.
Really?
And made some pretty terrific music, too. But, so even the people who were making the commercial slick stuff sometimes just got a little bit like, no, we need to go all the way. Or as Neil Young put it, when he did Harvest and then started releasing all those wonderful, darker, raw-edged albums, he said, I was riding right in the middle of the road, and I felt it was time to go into the ditch.
Yeah.
You need that.
Yes, you do.
But you became a Beefheart fan.
Yeah.
But then it went to this whole other level.
Right. Well, what happened was I became a big fan and got the next record. I was already up at college then, and it was announced that Beefheart was going to make his New York debut at a little club on the Upper West Side here called Lungano's, and me and some other fans came down. We drove down from New Haven, and I saw the show, and it just changed my life. That night was a turning point for me.
Whoa.
Because I went away saying, if I ever do anything in music, I want to play with this guy.
And this was
so impressive, I mean, it was the strong... It was stronger than any concert I'd seen. I guess the other concert that really impressed me, the first concert I remember that really impressed me, was seeing the Rolling Stones in 1965.
Oh. Yeah, I can understand the energy there. When did you see Beefheart live?
This is early 71.
Okay, so
January or February of 71.
So he was already at that point actually starting to have personnel difficulties and struggles.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you know the history of the band, he had personnel difficulties from the get-go because he had a very outsized personality, let us say. He used to say, I displace a lot of water, wherever I go. So for most people, it became, kind of a struggle to deal with many of his quirks. I don't mean to diss the guy.
No.
I think he's a really, on a good day, was one of the sweetest and kindest people that I knew. But,
oh, really? Could you tell some nice, because I've read a biography of him, and we all know, genius musician, unpredictable and
people,
difficult.
Yeah,
but at the same time...
Well, no, he could be, if he was, he was a very charming person on a one-on-one level. Because he loved to delight in very childlike appreciation of the universe and could find beauty in the most mundane situations and was a fascinating conversationalist. He would sprinkle his conversations with really almost James Joycean wordplay with puns and allusions. It was delightful, to be with him on those occasions.
And were you one of those people, even in later years, that you would get on the phone with at like 2 in the morning and you'd talk until 5 a.m.?
Yes. I logged many flying hours with him, I guess you could say.
In fact,
when I first moved to New York, I had a day job writing advertising copy for CBS Records. Before it was Sony, it was CBS Records. And one of the perks of this job, when I became an in-house staff copywriter, was we had phones that had unlimited calling, all over the world, I guess, Watts lines. And so I must have talked to him in a period of 7 or 8 years, at least an hour a day, every day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, this was one of the reasons I hung on that job as long as I did, because... I could do it very quickly.
Do you remember any, I know it's a terrible question, but do you remember any phrases that maybe never made it into his songs, or maybe that did, that stuck in your head?
Yeah, well, one was, I got him on the David Letterman show in 83 a couple of times, after the second show he came back, he was staying with me down here in the West Village, and started to improvise this song, kind of a blues, a cappella blues, that went, pork chop blew around the rhymes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I stabbed another bottle of wine. I was hungry, but I knew I had time. The smoke blew me down the line. It's quite bluesy and also original. I mean, really, a pork that's blue around the rind. I mean, this metaphor of rotting meat, you know. It was a good...
Well, he is named Beef Heart. I mean,
there you go.
I'm thinking about it.
He had it on the brain, what can I say?
But, amazing.
You know, it's very William Burroughs-esque. And in fact, Fast and Bulbous's first album was titled Pork Chop Blue Around.
Oh, that's so... So which albums were you involved with Beef Heart?
I remember the last two on Virgin. One, the first one is Doc at the Radar Station.
Right.
Came out in 1980, which was sort of a comeback album for him. And really, I was managing him to, I have to say, I think I did quite a yeoman job for him because we got him on the cover of Musician Magazine, and we did Saturday Night Live, we did a tour.
What, so were you managing? I thought you were playing guitar.
Both, yeah.
Oh.
Well, you see, I am basically not a businessman at all. And I told him so. And he said, Gary, I don't trust anybody, and I really think you can do the job. Because he knew how much, you know, I believed in his work and wanted to help him.
Hmm.
So he took advantage, let us say, of my good nature. But, I mean, I was a willing accomplice in this, you know.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We are chatting with Gary Lucas, guitar and, who knew, former manager of Captain
yes.
Beefheart.
Well, I try and keep that quiet because, you know, some people, if they're really believers in art for art's sake, will think he's not really, you know, an artist himself because he was a manager, but, you know, it's a lot of hooey.
Every artist now has to be a manager.
You
have
to manage yourself.
I
can't trust anybody to do it, you know.
And you said, you mentioned when we were talking before we went on the air that Beefheart was an insomniac, not surprisingly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
Are you as well? Yeah, sorry.
Well, he said to me he hated the tyranny of the sun going up and down. You know? He was fighting against it. He hated it. I mean, he loved to stay up for two or three days on end, you know.
Did he do, I mean, I'm assuming certainly in the 60s and 70s early when he was making that kind of music,
yeah.
He was... narcotically and pharmacologically enhanced.
Well, I don't know about narcotically, but, you know, let's say everybody sort of was smoking pot in that period.
Well, Zappa wasn't, but everybody else was. Okay.
Or dropping, you know, acid or psychedelics, but he was pretty anti-drug, too, you know. I mean, let's put it this way. I don't think that he didn't go through life with one of his hands tied behind his back, you know.
Very good.
He kind of tried everything. I think, you know, there's a certain, it just sort of goes with the territory.
Can I ask when the last time you were in touch with him was?
Actually, not since 1984. And,
84?
That's when I quit. Well, you know what? I prefer to remember the good parts of Don. Because after 5 years working for him, it just became a little much for me, and he stopped making music and said, I just want to do painting.
Right.
And I said, fine. I hooked him up then with Julian Schnabel, Michael Werner, who had a gallery in Cologne, Germany, that I think he's still affiliated with, and Mary Boone, you know, who also has a gallery in New York. And then said, Don, you know, you now... can do an art show. That's been your dream, was to segue out of music, and but I got involved to play your music, and you know, now that you just want to do art full time, I don't really see that you need me or there's a role for me.
Well, yeah, but you don't talk at Christmas or something like that.
Well, let's put it this way: he was so irascible at the end, but I don't want to tell tales.
Okay, okay,
and,
okay.
You know, I just want to remember the good parts. Right.
Well, I mean, but also, no, the question that everybody's always wondering about is, how's he doing? How's his health? What's the last appearance?
He's doing great. He had a show in Palermo. You know, if you go to beefheart.com, they show some beautiful watercolor drawings. You know, check that out.
He's
been in ill health.
Right.
I don't know for a fact. I don't want to go there.
But I've heard he's been in ill health for 15 years.
Yeah,
like death's door,
I mean,
for 15 years. So
right, he's very secretive and reclusive.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be in that inner circle, you know, anymore.
Okay.
So I just wish him the best, and I hope, and I kind of have a feeling he'll probably outlive us all, you know.
No, and his music is certainly going to outlive.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, and I do my best to still champion it. I think he's, you know, he should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, totally.
This guy's had more influence and more, you know, people like Bono, P.J. Harvey, Laurie Anderson, zillions of, you know, prominent...
Pere Ubu.
Had David Lynch send us a reading of a poem last week. You know, my band played at a tribute I mounted in Manhattan here at the Knitting Factory called Heart Night at the Knit.
Yeah.
And we packed him in, and, you know, Lynch sent us a poem.
That's so
of
cool.
Him reading from Trout Mask Replica. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's gone from an album that, as we said, it sounded like noise, and now we can quote it almost verbatim.
Yeah.
Some of the songs.
Oh, no, it's like the people who were into Fire Sign Theater, you know, or say the Monty Python. They're,
right.
They could recite the whole record, you know.
Now, before we spend the whole interview...
No, let's talk about Najma. They'll kill me.
We'll talk about Najma. Talk a little more about Najma, and then there's this whole other list of people you've worked with that I'm fascinated by.
But
so.
You should know about me, man. You should know. I have put out... This is, you know, I don't want to be eclipsed by all these
by
other...
By all means, man.
Singers, right? So, I, myself, personally, do a Wikipedia search on me. Or Google my name. Go to my website, Gary Lucas.
Well, yeah, I know you did background scoring for a movie called The Golem. That you did.
Yeah, but it's a foreground score. Foregrounded score. I've toured with The Golem all over the world. I've played the Venice Biennale with it. I've played it in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Tel Aviv, Prague, you know, opening film.
You don't have to defend yourself. We know that you're a great musician. It's cool. It's cool.
Yeah, but I should get more props in the world, I think, from...
Okay.
People who would think that I'm merely a collaborator or an enabler of all these people that I love, you know.
That's cool.
I'm more like a rainmaker, I might say, you know.
Well, have you done a lot of film scoring other than...
Yeah, I'm doing one. I just got one in the can for, this is funny, a documentary about the origins of Ivy League football, which is the origins of football, period. You know, it started in the Ivy League. Me as a Yale graduate, it was dear to my heart. You know, I'm not a jock, but when I was a kid, I loved to play football. And now there's this film, Leatherheads, that's out with George Clooney, I see, which is about the origins of pro football in the 20s. But originally, football really, you know, came out of rugby in the 1890s, and it was a very violent sport. This thing is going to premiere. It's a thing called 8. It's about Ivy League football.
And you did the score for the film.
Yeah, I did the score. It's going to premiere at the Yale Club in a couple of weeks. And then I guess the filmmaker, Eric Anjou, is planning film festival screenings. I've scored, let's see, for HBO and Maisel's Films. You may know Maisel's from Gimme Shelter. Yeah, Grey Gardens and Gimme Shelter, the Rolling Stones. Albert Maisel, who's a friend. I did a documentary about cotton pickers in Mississippi, contemporary cotton picking and the depredations of the industry, and that was called Lolly's Kin, The Legacy of Cotton. I scored that. I'm up to do a score now for a feature film called Hound Dog, which was a very controversial film that showed at Sundance last year, and it's been held up for various reasons, but now they're going ahead with a release. And
so you already did the score for it.
No. Oh, sorry?
Wait. The film, you know, they're going to add a score to it?
Well, it was shown, I think when they showed it at Sundance, it was shown with music that they didn't have licenses for.
Which happens,
you know, sometimes when stuff is just fresh out of the can. But for a commercial release, you know, if they're not going to pay license fees or somebody prevents it, then they go to original music.
Yeah.
And, anyway.
Do you play other instruments besides guitar?
Well, I dabble in them, but not really. Let's put it this way. I'm a very musical person, and I dare say, given, you know, the application of a certain amount of time spent, I could make music on just about anything. But I did, when I was younger, play the French horn for about 8 years. Yes, classically trained and on the French horn and the baritone horn.
So that was before even guitar?
Simultaneous.
Okay.
Lee, if you can believe it, when I was 9, I was given a musical aptitude test up in Syracuse, as all of my co-students were, and I scored a perfect score. Mm-hmm. And the band leader said, well, then, by all means, you must start the French horn. We need you. Because it's very difficult with intonation, and, you know, I guess I'd shown that my pitch was very good. But honestly, I'd never had the lip for it. I just... if you see a photo of me, I have a very thin upper lip. I don't really have what they call a good embouchure, and couldn't develop one. And it, within a week of starting the French horn, my father came forward and said, I think you should play the guitar. Very smart.
Father
man.
Said, okay.
Yeah, he put the idea in. Hi, this is Gary Lucas, and you are listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB Freeport.
Now, you did mention earlier when we were talking, by the way, we're chatting with Gary Lucas, guitarist and collaborator, but guitarist first. We're making that very clear.
Songwriter, and you might think Grammy-nominated songwriter.
Grammy-nominated songwriter and also part of the band that you formed called Gods and Monsters,
yes.
Which, as you also said, had some pretty, you know, well-known people in there, like Jeff Buckley and Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads.
Jerry is still in there. Jerry just produced a record, which is almost done for us, and he's on a live DVD, which we're negotiating a release for. We played last night without Jerry, and it sounded great.
I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that.
No. Jerry has got his own thing, but Jerry is not, you know, tied to us. Except that he likes playing with us. Now, Jerry's
cool.
Playing with us out in Oberlin College near Cleveland on Thursday night.
Well, how would you describe the difference between the music of Gods and Monsters and your solo work?
I think it's an extension of it, but it's more song-like because, you know, a lot of my solo work, if you know my early work, I had a record. My first album, which came out in 90, was called Skeleton at the Feast. It was totally instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the, you know, germs of ideas for songs later, you know, that I did, famous songs of mine, came out of some, you know, a tune or two on that record that were instrumentals.
Okay.
And that's why I go back to saying, you know, to me, the criteria for a good song is if the thing can be pared down to an instrumental without a lyric, then I think, you know, I mean, that's where many of the best of them get generated from.
Okay.
You know, that's my method. I've worked with other, you know, people on different methodologies, sometimes line by line, kind of back and forth. But I prefer it this way because there's an integrity about an instrumental. You know, if I'm writing it, you know, if it sticks in my mind after it's fully, after I think I've, you know, completed it.
Then you know.
I go to sleep and I remember it. It's like, you know, playing in my head the next day. And I think it's got, you know, a good, it's a candidate for a good song.
What is your website, by the way, so people can go there?
It's www.garylucas.com.
Okay.
I've put out nearly 20 records now since 90.
Wow.
Mainly on small labels, many of which have gone under. This is the nature of the indie, you know, hell I've been cast into, but be that as it may, I continue to release records, you know, by hook or by crook.
Well, are you happy about how the music industry has sea changed in the way music is promoted gone from... No, you're not. Ooh,
not okay. Really. Am I happy about it? I'm happy for one aspect of it, which is I now... about 11 records of mine, which have been out of print for some years, are now... You can all download the iTunes store.
Right.
Yeah. So for that, it's great. I mean, however, I do like things like liner notes and artwork, and, you know, so I miss that in a big way because I think that's an integral part of the experience of apprehending music. But where I see it really impacting negatively is this. Even with the tyranny of major label dominance of marketplace, which is pretty much the status quo for years, as we all know, and little indies more or less floundering along until maybe they get a regional hit and they used to get picked up or co-opted or whatever, absorbed by the bigger labels. There was still, there was a spirit that would emanate from this music. Particularly, I found, you know, a great joy and comfort in hearing a lot of this music growing up, you know, since the 60s, which I would regard as a golden age of rock music, of music in general. Now, I find a lot of that spirit is vanished. And I don't say it from a perspective of old fogyism, although I am getting on in years.
How old are you?
I say it just from, you know, the inner resonance that I feel or don't feel when I hear something. You know, if you read an essay by Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita,
mm-hmm.
and some other great books, he said the criterion for knowing what was real literature would be, after you would read a passage, you would feel a tingling in your spine. And I think the same is true of music, you know, at least for me, of music that I think has a certain integrity and quality. And I think a lot of that has gone out. And why it's gone out? Number one, I think it's over-proliferation, or pollution, if you might add, too much and nothing. Because in this day and age, with the advent of technological time-saving devices of many boxes you can buy to set up home studios and
mm-hmm.
and to generate music just by pressing buttons, you know, or you're circumventing a whole process that really gave a kind of patina or luster to the music that was produced. And I'm talking about mastering the craft of playing an instrument, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, like pretty much it's kind of, like I said, anybody can do it. You don't have to pay dues, pretty much. You can buy a few boxes, press a couple of buttons, make a musical artifact, press another button, and boot it up on the net.
True.
And bam, you know, you're a self-described artist.
But then again, if you go back, some of the most fun music of the 50s and 60s was garage bands.
Well,
and these were three-chord people, and they had the intensity, and they didn't know more than three chords. But
I'm not saying that's not necessarily the study of music or the knowledge, you know what I mean? You don't have to know anything about it to make music. I'm just saying the ease with which it's made. At least these garage band people played in bars and paid dues to be able to get into a studio. They weren't just like dummies who wandered in, or somebody, you know, in order for someone to, like, you know, invest in time in the studio, they had to have some germ or, you know, radiate some aura of authenticity. Or somebody might have thought, you know, I can make money off these groups. But they paid dues, you know. They honed their craft, you know. Be that as it may, whether you think, you know, it's not that simple even to make uninspired, you know, music. And it's really difficult to make inspired music.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into it. You know, it's not just beginner's luck of an amateur. There's too much and nothing. It's maybe it was better in the days where there was more of a hegemony of majors and a few indies, because there was less stuff coming out, you know.
It wasn't so cluttered with, like, emptiness.
Yeah. And how would you know where to look? And it's the same thing, too. You have to beat a drum by doing radio interviews, you know, like this, or trying to generate
horrible.
As much press as you can to get people to notice your stuff. It's not like an automatic given that if your stuff is really, you know, commercial, let's say, or has a quality that would attract an audience, the audience would find you necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, you can say, like, something might be on YouTube and have word of mouth, but at the same time, look at there, 20 million videos on YouTube.
Right.
I mean, good luck, you know.
So, you know, it's the democratization of the arts, a very bad thing, and I am not an elitist by any means, you know.
We're talking.
I like the lowest of the low, believe me.
Oh, so do I. I couldn't get low enough for me.
Okay, well, we have our heads in the gutter here.
We have a couple more minutes with Gary Lucas here in the neighborhood. Very, very happy to have him talking about music, where it's been, where it's going, and what he's done. And I do want to slide back into some of the folks that you're working with or have worked with, including, let's talk about the May 3rd gig at Joe's Pub.
Okay, Najma, to me, has one of the great, she's an extraordinary vocalist. She raises the hairs on the back of my neck. What's left of it.
Is it a Bjork-like way, or what kind of...
I can't really describe it other than to say you might have heard her. People might have heard her before if they saw that Page and Plant reunion documentary special, the Sandy Denny part of the Battle of Evermore.
Right.
Which was Page and Plant with some Indian musicians and, yes, an orchestra. And she was great in that. She's made other appearances with people like Andy Summers and his records. And it's a style of singing, if you know a bit about Indian music, that they call ghazal.
G-H-A-Z-A-L. I love those,
Yeah. It's devotional, beautiful music. You know, similar to Qawwali music, which is a Pakistani form of the same thing. But, you know, they just inspire me. And there's a bluesy quality about it that kills me, too. And this is, I would just say, a lot of the music that I like, my favorite music, is really fundamentally based on the blues. And if people ask me, is many different kinds of music. I've done, you know, Chinese pop music arrangements. I've played Wagner on the guitar, Jewish music, besides my dirty-ass psychedelic rock.
Yeah.
You know, I cover the waterfront, but fundamentally I'd say it boils down to a love of the blues. That's what informs my guitar playing. And Najma really is stone blues. She does slurs into microtonal pitches. Mm. It's like the space between a white and a black key on a piano, you know. You know, ivory. Those are quarter tones.
Beige.
The blues lives, you know, in those spaces. Those kind of, you know, that's what you can do with a voice. A real good blues singer bends and slurs notes. But you hear this in gospel music, and I love gospel music.
Okay.
A lot of devotional music. It's, to me, the voice of God is in those bent note spaces. You know, that's the highest spiritual form, is wailing. It's like the sound of a human struggling. That's what I like.
Wow.
I like synthesizers too. I like electronic music, but I'm always fundamentally a roots kind of guy. You know, for instance, John Coltrane on sax.
Hmm.
Listen to you know, Love Supreme.
Well, yeah.
To India. You know, he loved Indian music because he knew it was really close to the blues, and all jazz really stems out of the blues, or American jazz anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's one of my passions.
Well, I'm so glad I asked that question. That was so cool. Just getting all that feeling out of you. And I do want to. We can do this pretty quick, but just like sort of snapshots of some of the other folks that you've worked with, who wouldn't necessarily be known as beautiful singers, and yet they have the most unique kinds of voices and perspectives and musics. People like Lou Reed.
Oh, yeah. Lou is like, he's inimitable. He's like, you know, a classic American artist and visionary poet, you know, and there's a quality of his voice that really, you know, just about anything he sings, there's an authority and a humanity that permeates.
When did you work with him?
Let us say we had a mutual admiration society when I first met him, because he was, this is funny, John Zorn, the avant-garde saxophonist and composer, he organized a thing in Munich in 92 called the First Festival of Avant Jewish Music, or how did he call it? Radical Jewish Culture. That's what it was. And, I played the Golem there with Walter Horn, who was my keyboardist and collaborator. And Lou was there. And this, you know, was, I always suspected he was Jewish. I'm Jewish. There was a certain quality about, you know, the work that I can't put my finger on it, and maybe it's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is, but he never identifies. And
right, but
so
he did.
People
then,
don't know.
And anyway, and he has since then. He's certainly, you know, not ashamed to admit it.
He's going to shul every Saturday.
I don't know about that, but I've seen him at some seders, let us say, you know. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Oh, yeah. So, well, anyway, there's a great book. By the way, I'm about to go out and meet my friend Steve Bieber. To do a reading from that Awake anthology of the story called Me and the Golem, which I wrote about my experience playing the Golem in Prague, which I've done many times. Steve has a great book here. I'll put in a plug for Steve.
Sure, sure.
It's called The Heebie Jeebies at CBGB's, which is about the Jewish origins of punk rock.
Well, the Ramones.
Yeah.
A couple of the Ramones, yeah.
Danny Fields, all the people who were like the pioneers of the form pretty much have like some Jewish roots connections. Malcolm McLaren, for instance. There's a picture of Malcolm, you know, in his bar mitzvah suit.
Was it short for McLarowitz or something? No, no.
I don't know. They could be. So anyway, well, Lou, so I played with Lou shortly after I met him, which was at this thing in Munich. I hung out. I jammed with him.
Nice.
In the apartment here, and then at a Christmas party, and it was great. You know, he's one of the greats.
Was he, and again, here's another personality that is notoriously known as being difficult.
Well,
did you see that, or was he actually really cool?
I have seen it a little bit, but I have to say, I think he's gotten, you know, maybe it worked for him in the past, but he's been, you know, at least in the last few years, I've noticed kind of a sea change of, you know, where he doesn't feel so angry anymore, maybe. You know, I wouldn't say he's mellowed necessarily.
Oh. Okay.
But I don't see him snapping, you know, so acerbically as he was prone to do in the past.
Good.
And, yeah, you know.
That's nice to know because, you know, it's the one thing that always, he contributed so much and his music is so extraordinary that the one thing you, but you always heard these horrible stories.
No, it's not a nice business we're in here, you know. No. People definitely, you know, have experienced the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. I mean,
but you've also worked with, you've also worked with John Cale.
Yes, I have.
And Cale, you know, you don't hear that many stories about you. I mean, yes, but not...
He's not as flamboyantly known into the public as Lou, but I think John is one of the finest, you know, artists
totally agree.
I've ever met. I love his work, I think, you know, and also his contributions going back to the Velvet Underground and film music. He's really, you know, right up there.
And Guts and Fear and Paris 1919.
Fear is one of my favorite albums of all time. I just think, you know, he's definitely quite an extraordinary creative person.
And what is your Cale connection? How did you work
with
him?
John was in my gym, you know.
Okay.
And so was Lou for a while. The printing house right down the street here in the West Village. He was in there for a time. So, but I met him before that. I think we did a show out at Maxwell's, a double bill. Or let's say I was opening.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, he was headlining. Back when I was first really starting out under my name, doing a solo guitar act around, this is 88 or 89. Yeah. And we hit it off. And then, you know, I would run into him from time to time and always enjoyed seeing him. You know, we did actually collaborate on a song, which has never, you know, been released officially yet.
Oh, okay.
But I thought it was pretty great. It was called Peter Laurie.
Hmm.
His title, his lyrics, yeah. So, I don't know. I'll have to talk to him about putting... Maybe I'll put that up on the net. You might see it for a fleeting moment on GaryLucas.com.
And what about this one or two more people? Because I just love, obviously, hearing about these kinds of things. Dr. John.
Dr. John, now, I don't really have a close personal connection with, but Hal Wilner, the producer, who is an old friend, who's great. Hal works for Saturday Night Live, but you may know him in music for these extraordinary multi-artist tribute albums. He was the first to do this, to the best of my knowledge. He did, you know, a Thelonious Monk and a Sun Ra and a Nina Rota record, and he did all sorts of tributes. He did a Tim Buckley tribute, which is how I met Jeff Buckley.
Uh-huh.
You know, he brought us together there. So Hal's a great catalyst and, you know, friend and really exquisite taste. He did a Mingus tribute album that was called Weird Nightmare, and I do a track on there that Dr. John is reciting, which is really, it would give me shivers to hear it.
And he seems like he would have been really cool.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, Gree-Gree, his first album on Atlantic, I put in my top 10 albums of all time.
Oh. Okay.
I listen to that on my iPod, you know, Nano, all the time. It's got, you know, just some it just drips pure emotion and spirit and swampy, you know, and humor and... he's just one of the greats, you know.
Cool.
He's an American treasure.
And one more person I do want to ask about. One of my very, very favorite people to listen to, anyway, Nick Cave.
Ah, okay. Well, Nick, what can I say? He's a diamond in the rough. He's a maverick who has managed to really, you know, build a very large worldwide fan base without, you know, huge record sales, at least in this country, just through sheer perseverance. He's a poet, you know, and a humorist. He's quite talented as an, you know. I first met him. We did a collaboration for John Hockenberry's show on NPR.
Huh.
Where Nick read from his book, And the Ass Saw the Angel, and I just improvised on steel guitar. Similar to what I'm going to do tonight with Steve Bieber, by the way. And that was really good. Then he invited me to do a similar reading guitar collaboration at a festival in Rotterdam, which was a lot of fun. And we stayed in touch. I saw him in Melbourne, Australia. I was playing the Golem, opening the Australian Jewish Film Festival in November in both Melbourne and Sydney. And I heard I was doing a radio interview down there on the national radio, and Mick Harvey from
Bad Seeds
rang up, and he said, "Gary, how you doing? Hey, you know, Nick's in town. He's going to do..." They had a retrospective, anyway, in Melbourne at a huge national art museum that was kind of Nick's career in a nutshell, with artifacts of manuscripts and photographs and a beautiful, beautiful exhibition. So on the way over to my gig on the first night, I did it a couple of nights in both cities, I stopped in, and there was Nick sitting in the midst of all of this kind of jumble that they were mounting on the walls around him to reflect his career. And he was incredibly nice and warm, and, you know, I love this guy. I think he's great.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, it's great to hear about all these people, but also absolutely about the music and the career of Gary Lucas. Please, everybody, go to GaryLucas.com to find out about all the different projects that he's working on solo, the film scoring stuff, and also the things that he's doing with Najma Akhtar.
Oh, come to that show.
May 3rd at Joe's Pub.
Joe's Pub at 9:30, because it's something really special. It would be attention well worth, you know, putting in on your part.
Well, I really appreciate the attention and the time that you've given us in the neighborhood, Gary Lucas.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Dave.